aired the Murdoch News at 5. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Westbury on Trim and Henlees, Jeff Gollop, plus Lib Dem leader and Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Catalonia clamped down. Well, they're not just closing the Parliament, they're taking over the police and the television and the radio stations too, from Madrid. And Mogadishu last Saturday, mass murder. But who did it and why? And why has Donald Trump not said anything about the attack? Doesn't he care, or did he have a hand in it? After all, it's a strategic place just around the corner from Yemen, which the Americans are involved in right now. And Israeli weapons found in an ISIS cache as more evidence arrives on our desks and is failed to be reported by the London media. The Israelis and the US and then even the Brits are providing ISIS with logistical support. Not just that, the cash to pay mercenaries too, without which they wouldn't last 5 minutes. Plus, an old new HTV series from 1972, in fact, The Pretenders, all about the Monmouth Rebellion. It's just been released for home use for the first time since the 1970s. It's about a group of travelling players in Somerset's Pitchfork Rebellion back in the 17th century. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius, windy with showers. Also, highs of 14 Celsius this weekend. That's very windy with showers tomorrow. Breezy, though, with less showers on Sunday. Next week, there's highs of 16 Celsius, a mainly cloudy week with showers and a few sunny spells. Next weekend, the 28th and the 29th of October, leading up to Halloween, highs of 16 degrees Celsius, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now, Politics Show, here on the Politics Show, I've put together, finally, what we used to call it the City Slackers List, a red list of MPs and councillors who simply just don't reply to invitations. Well, usually I'll put at least three or four invitations out, but I've said to myself, after five invitations, if you don't even reply, you're on the red list. And let me tell you, first, the first two people on that list are, hey, guess who? Bristol's Mayor, Marvin Rees, the Labour leader. Also, Kerry McCarthy, Labour MP for Bristol East. The pair of them just don't respond. I wanted to ask Kerry about vaccinations, about her attitude towards Jeremy Corbyn, whether she supports him now after she called him a cult leader last year. And she was convinced that he was going to lose her seat for her. Does she still think that? Love to ask you, Kerry. But you won't respond to my my invitations. Also, I wanted to talk to Marvin about the arena, why he's organised a protest against his own cuts, and what he's doing about the slave trade memorial. And on the blue list, Jack Lopresti, who's a Conservative, and Filton and Bradley Stoke MP, and also Chris Skidmore, Tory MP for Kingswood, and he's the Minister for the Constitution. Neither of those are actually able to make it. At least they reply and say no, can't come. Gold stars go to Bristol North West Labour MP Darren Jones, who's quite happy to respond and chat anytime you want, really, as well as Labour MP for Bristol South, Karen Smith, and Thangam Debonair, Labour MP for Bristol West, who will be on in the new year. So, after we've got the red list, the gold list, and I suppose we call it the black list as well, it's Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the Politics Show from the Lib Dems. Gary, just take us through this week's events at the Human Resources Committee, because I understand there were even attempts to try and stop you going to the committee because you're apparently a security risk or something.
Yes, kind of possibly acting on instructions from the mayor, Marvin, who seems to have been desperately embarrassed by a few of our quite legitimate revelations as to what's been going on with regard to the chief executive.
So where do you draw the line? What are you saying? What aren't you allowed to say? Because it is quite a confidential thing, human resources. It's all about people's personal information to do with council officers, staff.
In actual fact, Kai Dodd shows the level of incompetence. He didn't even know that he was actually theoretically complaining about something on a completely different committee that wasn't actually anything to do. It wasn't the HR committee. He actually complained that we let out that the mayor actually voted to get in the previous chief executive on the recruitment panel. Well, that's a little bit strange, considering the mayor put out a press release a month in advance of the committee making its recommendation that he was going to be recommending her. So, it was hardly a secret, was it?
It certainly wasn't. What would you say to that? I mean, because it is quite important, isn't it? Who is replacing this new staff? And we're also talking about some very big salaries and a complete, really restructuring of the senior management team, if you can call them that, at the council.
Well, the whole thing is a total shambles. The previous chief executive came in 7 months ago on a sizable salary. There were all sorts of stories coming out from staff as to what was actually going on. Then she left under very mysterious circumstances. The mayor didn't bother to tell us that he'd given her a £70,000 golden goodbye. When that actually came out, he then tried to claim it was the responsibility of the HR department, HR committee, for putting it in the contract. But since then, it's actually emerged that it wasn't in the contract at all, and it was purely a voluntary payment that he made to her, which was, after 7 months, seemed rather generous to me.
Well, you say a shambles, but it's obviously been quite nice for her.
Well, I mean, there are people that have managed to go around a number of different authorities and work for a short period of time and then get payoffs. It's public money, though, and things need to be taken far more carefully than actually happened in this case.
Well, I mean, if Marvin was here, I'm sure he'd say something along the lines of, well, we needed to get these new people in place, and that was the only way to do it.
Well, getting them in place is not very good if you pay a lot of money for recruitment. They work for 7 months and then leave, and then you give them a large payoff. And in actual fact, what's even more concerning is the huge number of senior staff who've been running out the door at a rate of knots over the last year or so.
And, hang on, haven't they been sacked rather than resigned?
Well, a whole mixture. Some of them just can't stand the atmosphere they're actually being asked to work under, and that is not a good state of affairs at all.
Now, just as we were walking in here, you talked about some proposed changes to the Constitution. Am I right about that? Because that really is worrying. We're already in a situation where there's a massive centralisation of power gone on over the last 3 or 4 years, actually since we had the mayor vote, and we decided to have a mayor, apparently, on a very small turnout. Now we're talking about actually changing the rules. Now, in what way is that
happening? Well, firstly, I'll guarantee that when the Bristol public are given the choice, do you want the mayor system or not, which they will have in the near future, hopefully, then they will reject it because it's been a resounding failure. And it does lead to centralisation and apparently to people who can't work with others and actually just want to be totally in control. There's now moves from the mayor, which will almost certainly go through because the Labour Party will tick it through, to centralise things. They've already got rid of neighbourhood partnerships, so local decision-making is being got rid of. And there's a number of other matters with regard to who decides what information is available, the ability to question a mayor, which will actually reduce accountability even further.
The thing is that Marvin all the time is talking about being open and transparent.
Yes, so he is. but in practice, it's exactly the opposite. And a lot of people have been very, very surprised. I think at least 50% of it is down to the post and the structure rather than just the individuals.
Not the Bristol Post.
Giving somebody unlimited power and telling them that, you know, they can just get on with it.
Well, he hasn't got unlimited power, has he? Because he has to get various measures through a vote of the full council. Quite a lot of stuff has to go. Can you just explain what sort of decisions have to be voted on by the councillors that we elect, and what sort of decisions is Marvin and the cabinet making? Because, I mean, we need to know what is the purpose of voting, don't we?
We do, and it's very unfortunate that power has been taken away from councillors to a huge extent. And in actual fact, I mean, a huge amount is now being concentrated with the mayor. And there's a grab all the time for more power to be centralised and less of it decisions to be made by councillors. In theory, we vote through a budget once a year. In theory, it's all the councillors responsible for that. But in practice, it's been tested elsewhere. If the councillors disagree with the mayor can go to court and get his vote through. So we actually control very little, and more and more of what councillors do is try to mitigate the damage being done by the mayor and try to highlight what's actually happening, well, the reality of things. I mean, like, I'll give you an example of the arrogance with regard to the libraries. The lunatic plans came out for consultation a few months ago. They were not supported by any councillors, and basically when a scrutiny committee came up with an alternative plan, he refused to listen to it and it just basically put out a spoiler to ignore it completely.
Okay, could you also take us through what you're allowed to tell us about HR this week?
Well, we
is folks, human resources, what we used to call personnel.
Yeah, it covers a range of things. And actually, my colleague, Tim Kent, asked a great long list of questions, which flushed out a lot of what had actually happened with regard to the departure of the previous chief executive. Some of the stuff, though, could not be debated publicly. And myself, the Conservative representative and the Green Party representative are demanded at the agenda conference a session afterwards so that some of these questions could be looked at that was in camera, because some of it was confidential. And what happened? The Labour chair tried to close the meeting before the discussion could happen, jumped up, said, "I'm off," and he's going. And I can tell you there was not a lot of happiness around that table. So some of the questions did get asked, and the officer in charge of HR and the council lawyer were there, and we did manage to ask them one or two questions.
Did you get any answers?
We did get one or two. And we did get one or two answers, none of which were surprising at all, but actually caused even more concern. And I suspect more of this will come out. What we are demanding is a proper independent inquiry into everything that's gone on from the recruitment to the final departure of that previous chief executive, the 7 months it happened, because the city has been... city council has been in turmoil.
The thing is, Gary, this is water under the bridge now. It's happened. Surely, you know, you don't want to be poring over this forever.
Well, that individual thing has happened, but it's happening again. Before she departed, she brought up a new plan for the management of the senior officers. And then, of course, before it got presented, she disappeared. It's supposed to be overseen by the head of HR department. And one of the big concerns is that so many of the staff are temporary and don't stay. And believe it or not, the head of HR, who drew up these plans and is responsible for carrying them through, is on a fixed-term contract which runs out shortly, and nobody knows whether she'll be there or not.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit shambolic. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I know you're not privy to the inside detail here, but it does sound like there's a lot of changes going on, and as a result, basic boxes are not being ticked.
Well, I learn more about this business every week on the show than I would ever otherwise know. And I haven't really got much comment to make about the detail. I think I agree that the mayoral system was a mistake. But I have to say, I mean, if we had a non-mayoral system, given the electoral results that we had at the last election, we would have had a Labour-led authority with no other parties involved. Having a mayoral system... that, of course, the mayor doesn't have to have anybody else involved, but he has chosen to have other parties involved in his administration.
Is that true, Gary?
No. Basically, he got one token person from each of the other three parties, and then parted company with our representative who was doing a decent job.
I suppose there's a big point you're making there is, okay, so Marvin has assembled a bunch of people from different parties around, but is it his choice or is it the party's choice?
It's his choice, and basically they're not working as a cabinet. And actually, there was very little that could be described as cabinet working under the previous mayor either. The mayor has total control. The difference is, if you have a leader model, whichever party it is, the leader is answerable to the councillors and has to behave in a sensible manner. In the present situation, that doesn't happen.
So anyway, it's a big week for Marvin this week with his annual address, which he started. George Ferguson didn't used to do this. He takes over some big hall up at the university and with a whole bunch of people, most of whom have been invited. I noticed the master of ceremonies is this chap called Andrew Kelly, who I got to know quite well while I was on the Cultural Development Partnership. He's actually line managed by, he was anyway, by Business West. So although a lot of his salary is paid by Bristol City Council and the programmes that he does, like the Festival of Ideas, are seen as sort of rolled out as part of the council's work, actually, Andrew doesn't really work for the council. He works for the business community, largely. But it was interesting to see him, anyway, introduce this. Jeff's also joined us now, Jeff Gollop from the Conservatives. Jeff, did you and Gary, did either of you go and see Marvin in his great speech this week?
No. I've read the detail.
And you, Gary?
No, I certainly didn't, but I've had a good chuckle reading through some of it as well.
What was it made you chuckle then?
Oh, the whole, it's a sort of, he's just lost touch with reality. The first job of the mayor in charge of the council is to make the council work and run efficiently. That is not happening. There's chopping and changing all over the place. And then there's ideas, supposedly, which are never, ever going to happen. And the gap between what he's saying and what reality is just huge.
Jeff, would you agree with that?
Well, you know, Gary and I tend to differ on quite a number of things. And one of them is that is actually the mayoral model. And I'm a great believer that Bristol needs a mayor making decisions and taking the city forward.
Is it a bit like a chairman of the board?
Yeah, it's like that. And actually, I'm surprised at what Gary says, because a lot of politics has to be based on coming up with visions, coming up with ideas and trying to make things happen. Now, there's quite a few things in Marvin's visions I might not agree with, and I might not agree with the way he's proposing going about doing them. But actually, this city needs to have people who have a thought for the future and have some grand plans. We then need to assess them and see whether they're workable, and that's possibly where Gary and I might agree. But I don't condemn him for coming up with the grand plans.
Well, hang on a minute, because there are all sorts of different types of chairman of the board, aren't there? I mean, you will get some who will make sure they listen to everybody and then come to a collective decision. You'll get others that just try and railroad through whatever they want to do, Jeff. So which one is Marvin?
I think we need more time to see that. I think any pragmatic mayor or chairman of the board actually needs to take a lot of people with them, and that's not just the people who agree with them, it's the people who maybe doubt and challenge them as well. And it's a very delicate art to succeed.
But
in getting
there will be some people who never agree with Marvin, won't there?
There will. There'll be some people who never agree with Gary, and there'll be even some people who never agree with me. But I don't think there are some doubters you will never convince. But I do think in moving a city forward, you've got to have an element of consensus in delivering something that's for the better for the majority of the city.
I noticed that your colleague Richard Eddy was very critical of the way that Marvin dealt with the whole chief executive business. So what do you make of that? I mean, I've tried to get hold of Richard, tried to get him on here, haven't managed. So I'm not asking you to be his spokesperson, but what's the party's view?
I don't think we have a party view. I think we're still trying to understand all the facts and all the issues.
There's been a lot of chief executives and a lot of money paid out, and it just seems to be this is our money. In fact, we're even talking about the possibility of trying to get council tax off of people who've got no money, which is and that money's going to to pay off people who haven't actually served
Gary
out their time.
Gary knows more about this than I do because he serves on the HR committee, and certainly one of my suggestions is that we should start selling tickets for the HR committee because it could be a way of reducing the deficit.
Make a bit more than parking tickets, even,
absolutely.
Maybe.
Absolutely.
I have quite a number of political differences with Richard Eddy, but actually on this one, we have communicated a lot because we've people there that were on right on this from the beginning with the experience saw what was going on, and we've both been outraged. It's been absolutely shocking.
I mean, you've implied.
I had a conversation with Richard only today, and I did say it was quite a remarkable achievement of the mayor to get Gary and Richard, of all people, agreeing on what they were saying. I think this has got some way to go. The bit that perhaps Gary can help me to understand is it appears that we appear to have paid a chief executive who asked to go a sum of money for notice when it was her who didn't give the notice. And I must admit, at that point, I think if that's the case, Tony, you're absolutely right that money has been
thrown away.
It starts to look, potentially more like a bung than a payment in some kind of legal context. Anyway, Gary.
Firstly, the £70,000 got kept secret, which is concerning in itself. Secondly, when it got exposed in various places that it had been paid out, and I didn't actually know about it until a few weeks ago. I didn't know until fairly recently, and neither did Richard. When it got exposed, there was then an attempt to say it was all the HR committee's fault, which is absolute nonsense, because we gave guidance on having new contracts for the chief executive to avoid the £200,000 payment that Marvin made a little while ago, because the previous chief executive was not on a fixed-term contract. And we said fixed-term contract and put in recommendations, but these were not what were used to pay the our recently departed chief executive a huge amount of money. That was pure payment. Marvin's decision.
Amazing.
I don't know how you found out, Gary, but I accept I'm only a backbencher, but I found out from private eye.
And me.
That was how I found out. There was no consultation or even provision of information.
Absolutely.
I mean,
this is
really worrying because you on HR should be being given these figures.
Of course.
Have you got any redress if they simply hide stuff at the mayor's office?
No, it's happening all the time, unfortunately. There's very little that can actually be done.
I think we need a few spy cameras in there, don't we? And maybe someone to go in late at night if they can manage to not break in and just take a few photographs of documents in the mayor's office to see what's really going on. Maybe listen to the phones. This is supposed to be a democracy. We're supposed to be living in a city where, I mean, for example, freedom of information requests and things like that, and the committees are supposed to be managing this, not the mayor's office.
Well, committees should at least have oversight and be able to comment on things, make certain what needs to be public is made public. But in this particular case, that money, the information came from people very close to the centre of the administration here. There was a fair amount of detail that went to private eye and elsewhere, and it was pretty clear that a number of people were pretty well informed, but it wasn't coming to councillors and it wasn't coming to the public.
I mean, it's just taking a step back for a minute. I mean, this seems like Marvin is running things a little bit like he would run a company, a board of a company, where obviously there is confidentiality.
Well, no, most companies are far more efficient than this. I mean, if you're going to do stupid things like this and then try and get involved in a cover-up, you do it rather more efficiently if you're in private enterprise.
Jeff? Sorry, we've got a bit of an alarm going off here. I don't quite know what that's about. But let's not be distracted by it, Jeff.
I would agree. I don't believe private companies would get away with this sort of management or lack of information and accountability. And the problem always, and where any administration is ill-advised to go on in this way, is that when you only find out information by by probing, you cannot help but wonder whether there is more information that you haven't been told.
Yeah. I think there's clearly more information on this particular case. I mean, what we were actually told by Marvin was that the reason that this lady gave up voluntarily a £160,000 a year job was that, you know, which she just moved into 7 months beforehand, was to, look after her family. Well, given that he then gave her a £70,000 bung, or whatever you might call it, it's very, very concerning. We really need to be asking what was the real reason that she actually had to go.
Anyway, so back to the state of the city address, which is Marvin's great chance to talk to the world. Of course, when the City Council put it onto YouTube, they put it on there with no comments being allowed. So, of course, there'll be lots and lots of people that will be making all sorts of witty comments, which we're not allowed to hear. And, of course, factual inaccuracies, potentially pointing those out as well. And also asking questions about what wasn't mentioned. Now, a couple of things I noticed before we start and have a listen to a bit of Marvin's speech, because we're not allowed to have him on here. I mean, he just doesn't turn up, even when he says he's going to turn up. It'd be nice to ask him those questions directly, but we're going to hear a bit from him. So one thing was the whole idea of a slavery memorial, which a lot of people that voted for him thought that he was going to be, you know, was going to be one quite important plank of Marvin's mayoral term. Particularly because many people in the city, obviously including the West Indian community, want to have some sort of memorial to the slave trade in Bristol. And then also the arena. So I wonder on both of those, Jeff, what you make of the missing from the speech.
Well, I think if we start with the slave trade issue, I think that this is an issue that does very seriously divide the city, and I understand that there are a number of people who feel quite simply it is part. That the slave trade was part of our heritage, not a part that anyone would wish to have been there, but was there. And that the sooner that we put that behind us and get on with life, the better.
Well, people have said the same about the Holocaust, haven't they?
They say the same about the Holocaust. The fact is that I recognise that we do have to acknowledge our past. I am reluctant because I don't know enough about those who were involved and what happened at the time. I believe Bristol was also a key part in the abolition movement. So I think we have to recognise that there is a lot that Bristol can be proud of what happened over that horrendous part of our history. But I find that if someone's made a pledge that they're going to do something, I would expect them to carry on doing it. And something that is achievable, even in under financial pressure, could be referred to, rather than larger and more grandiose schemes, which might be rather more of a challenge. And I think, you know, the second point you raise is the arena, and that, if you like, is one of the other extremes. I'm concerned that having changed or removed the original contractor because of the price that was going to be charged, we are a year later, and the building price inflation that will have applied to the contract in the meantime will mean that the price is probably going to be as high as the original contractor was going to charge us, and we are no further forward. So I would certainly be saying that we actually need to have a decision and some action rather than apparently waiting for another report and another group of people to sit down and have a discussion.
I mean, isn't the fact that it's never going to happen now because there just simply isn't the money for it?
The money is set aside for the originally hypothecated cost. So it would only be how one would find... You'd either have to find the extra funding for the increasing cost, or you would have to reduce the specification to be able to use the funds that are currently available. But here we are a year on from when it was the contractor was cancelled, and we don't know what the options are and what is going to be suggested.
In the meantime, we've got a road to nowhere, haven't we? This beautiful blue bridge has been built across the Avon, and is it the Cut? I'm not sure quite what that particular bit of water is, but just around the back of Temple Meads by the old Royal Mail buildings.
It's a wonderful bridge. We were assured by officers that any work on infrastructure on that site would have a value whatever happened to the site. So that's what we've been told. And I'm only relaying that. I'm not commenting on it.
Yeah,
it's a bit of
a white elephant, at least looks at the moment. Anyway, Gary, would you like to just comment on the arena and on the slavery?
Right.
The slavery
well, firstly, with regard, the bridge does make that piece of land, the island, usable. What it's going to be used for, I think we're all starting to worry and guess about.
Usable by pedestrians.
It's a piece of land there, which is near the city centre, is now valuable because it's got access which it didn't have before. Having said that, I'm rather worried about the direction that the arena is going. I agree with regard to the concern about inflation pushing up real costs, and are we just going to be dithering away and finish up with nothing happening at all? Having said that, I mean, the previous mayor was gung-ho and didn't get anything done. He was actually handed a position when the land was taken from the Regional Non-Development Agency and given to more sensible organisations, so the land got freed up. A lot of the years in the past was nothing to do with the city council, why things didn't happen. Anyway, the land is now usable. One extra aspect which hasn't been looked at really is that all the university housing going on there actually potentially makes the whole scheme less financially viable. When we build houses, we get new homes bonus from government, we get council tax coming in. Now, instead, there's going to be a lot of university accommodation going in there. We don't get the same money. I'm concerned that that will, in actual fact, have another negative effect on the balance sheet and might make it even more difficult to be able to afford to build the arena. With regard to the slave trade, I'm a great believer that people learn from history, should learn from history, whether the history was palatable or not. And if you try to sweep it underneath the carpet, then you basically lose out, and everybody loses out, as in Holocaust denial. But on the other hand, if there wants to be, counter statues, if you like, because there are one or two statues around which some people don't like, then the statues to the people who campaigned to get rid of slavery would, I think, be quite popular.
Well, there's a great article actually in the Bristol Post today by Tristan Cork, Buns, Sermons and Slave Songs, How Slave Trader Edward Colston Was Awkwardly Commemorated on Anti-Slavery Day. On the same day St Mary Redcliffe Church was illuminated to mark Anti-Slavery Day, they held a service commemorating slave trader Edward Colston. Tristan Cork was allowed past the police guard and joined the congregation this week. They were singing hymns, prayers were said, and there was a sermon. But this was no ordinary church service at St Mary Redcliffe Church in the heart of Bristol. It wasn't just the baker's crates filled with hundreds of large sugar-sprinkled buns. The fact the service wasn't advertised, on the church's own website, or the involvement of pupils from both the local primary and secondary schools. This was the Colston Society's annual service, held every year in Bristol, one of several events at Bristol's prominent churches and the cathedral at this time of year. I think the charter days, maybe is that in November, I'm not sure, from the Merchant Venturers. Anyway, all involve local schools who established to commemorate and celebrate the good deeds and generosity of Edward Colston, a man who has 296 years after his death become a divisive figure in the city. Those campaigning against Bristol's widespread permanent commemoration of Colston, and there are concert halls, pubs, schools, roads and homes named after him to go with a prominent statue in the city centre, talk darkly about these mysterious church services that update this commemoration annually. Outside the church, one campaigner had even written slogans about the services brainwashing children in chalk on the pavement while they filed in. Now, we've had, there's a Counter Colston group in Bristol, which is part of the Bristol Radical History group. There's also a big stained glass window in Bristol Cathedral dedicated to Edward Colston, based on him. And there were placards outside saying, I'll start with you, Jeff, on this. How is worshipping mass murderers outstanding education? A service at St Mary Redcliffe Church honouring Edward Colston drew protests on Wednesday. Christine Townsend from protest group Countering Colston was pictured outside the church.
Well, I think comments like that are as divisive as anything can be, because the implication of mass murder, Rick, I know of no evidence that suggests that, and I think...
Well, I mean, hang on,
comments along those lines...
As people were rounded up in Africa, Jeff, of course, many of them were just thrown overboard on the way to the Caribbean.
Absolutely. But look, what we've got to look at is that this is a mixture of a whole series of historic issues. I do not believe anyone today could do anything other than condemn slavery. So this isn't about whether one believes in slavery or not. It's whether one believes that someone was deliberately and knowingly harming others. What they were doing was wrong. But I actually would put it to you that it's not any more wrong than the fact that my grandfather was a tied farmhand.
But I mean,
had no freedom and no liberty whatsoever.
There were active measures taken to keep this from the people of Bristol, to keep it from the people in Britain, that this slave trade was even going on, and the extent of it, weren't there? I mean, because the slaves were kept away from Bristol generally, they were just caught over in Africa, trapped like animals, and then put on these ships. Many of them died on the way.
The thought of trading human beings is
so. Why is that not mass murder?
I don't believe one has any proof that anyone was deliberately... I believe murdering is the intention of killing someone. I don't believe there's any evidence of that, but it doesn't make it any more acceptable. The fact is that it is a totally unacceptable way of dealing with other human beings. But it happened because at a time... people condoned it. They condoned it when they were the slave traders condoned it. The people who bought and sold slaves condoned it, and the merchants who traded in them condoned it. That doesn't make it right. But actually, we also need to move on. I wish we were concentrating more on dealing with and confronting modern day slavery, because that is within our power to deal with.
Well, some would talk about wage slavery as slavery.
Yeah.
When you get sanctioned from the DSS, you may then just simply be evicted, and you may have no money to even buy food. There was a story this week in the Mirror about children having to go through bins to try and find food. Now, that whole concept of wage slavery, when the money that you can earn, or if you can't get a job at all, I mean, we're surely going back to the 1930s here with the big hunger marches, that sort of thing, potentially.
Potentially, and it's wrong that we are having to pay, benefit and subsidise people who are in work not being paid enough to actually provide accommodation and food. I agree.
What do you make of this interesting coincidence that the Colston Society have got their annual service on the same day as Anti-Slavery Day at St Mary Redcliffe, and also the children who are taken there, from many of them from the merchant venturer controlled schools, they're given a bun. Obviously they then think, well, that's rather nice, thank you very much. And the younger ones were smuggled out a side entrance, so they didn't see any of the boards which were put there by the Counter Colston group.
Well, as you know, my whole philosophy is that things should not be done in secret, whether it's that or other things. When things are done in a covert way, there's something probably to hide.
What about, do you think it makes sense to be talking about Edward Colston still? I mean, why?
I think it's very sensible to be talking about it, because I think it's important that people understand now what the problem was. I mean, the mass murder is one description, but in actual fact, so alien was the thought processes then that I don't think these slave traders even regarded their slaves as human. I think that they regarded him as so completely different. They were unable to unable to think in a properly decent manner.
Maybe I can,
and that sort of attitude.
Maybe I can bring you in on this, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, because there was definitely a sort of attitude to the Africans by the slave traders that these were almost subhuman, almost like Untermensch, a bit like the Nazis treated the Gypsies and the Jews.
Well, I think it's historically, but the way the slave trade worked is people died pretty easily when they got to the West Indies, even if they got to the West Indies, which is why the slave trade went on for such a long time, because the conditions once they arrived in the West Indies were basically exterminatory. So that's the first point. I think the other issue here is, why are the merchant venturers in charge of schools? And why are they then able to bus children in, including primary school children?
Well, they would say the merchant venturers now are a very different group.
Yeah, well, I would listen. I'm an old socialist. I think schools should be run by the local authority, not by the merchant venturers, and therefore we wouldn't have this kind of problem emerging if they were all run by the local authority. And don't forget, we're paying for these schools. The merchant venturers are just using public money
to manage them. Gary, what do you make of that comment?
I'm very, very concerned about the forced academisation. Primary school, where I'm a governor at the moment, we're having to take defensive measures because the government are making it very difficult for local authorities to support primary schools remaining in the state sector, which was our very clear intention. That's what we wanted to do. We're clubbing together and having to do it with a number of other like-minded primary schools to protect ourselves against what's happening in the market. And I'm afraid the government are making things into a market that I don't actually approve of.
Jeff, merchant venturers running schools and smuggling kids out the side door so they don't have to see the notice by the Counter Colston people?
Well, do you know, after all these years I've been coming on your show and agreeing with Martin on lots of things, I've actually found something I can disagree with him on now, because, you know, we make these comments about wanting to maintain the state control of education, and actually we look at the quality of the education that Bristol was producing when it controlled schools in Bristol, and it was one of the worst performing authorities in the country. So actually, there is no proof on the record of what we managed to deliver in terms of quality that suggests that that model worked. What we've actually done with the academisation process is see interested parties, and that includes the merchants, who happen to have an exceedingly useful amount of skills in running organisations and make them perform effectively, and apply that to education, to adult care, and a variety of other areas across the city. And in my view, the city is better for it. So actually, I don't believe we should be closing out those opportunities. Education is probably the most important thing that we provide for this city, and getting the very best results we can without political dogmas how we do it is actually the most important.
Well, actually, Jeff, as somebody who's involved in the administration for a few years, and when we did come in the administration, it was one of the worst performing local authorities in the country. Our schools were disastrous. We couldn't even recruit teachers because they didn't want Bristol on their CV. It was that bad. But we actually then moved to a model, a mixed model, where we were not forced to go down an academisation role, but in some cases that was the right option. Where we part company dramatically from the Conservatives is where now it's effectively being enforced on schools that local authorities will be squeezed out of business. And that is wrong because it removes a level of choice that ought to be there.
Okay, William, we're back to
that, but I would also say the merchant schools have some of the highest levels of demand in schools in the city, and those applications are coming from all races, and therefore there is something there whereby people are recognising the strength of the quality of the education.
I mean, isn't
provision.
It the fact that the merchant venturers have got far more money than the government or the council can spend? And I mean, surely we shouldn't just be allowing the richest people in the city to do the educating.
We certainly aren't only allowing the richest people in the city, but if those who have the business skills to help our schools to succeed are willing to do so, then I, for one, would welcome them with open hands, because we need that expertise.
Well, I'm still not convinced. I'm obviously on Gary's side of this argument. My father was a head teacher for many, many years in secondary schools, in comprehensive schools. What's happened with Colston Girls School, of course, they were absorbed into the system with an existing intake, many of which don't actually live in Bristol, so they come from outside the city. And, of course, when you absorb those schools into the system, then your average goes up. But nothing much has changed, in fact. And it's very difficult for people around where Colston Girls School is to get into Colston Girls School, because the existing clientele have been taken on as, you know, because previously the parents used to have to pay for the fees in Colston Girls School. Now they don't have to. And ultimately, I believe, as my father does, that schools are cooperative. They shouldn't be in competition. It's all things like playing fields and so on should be shared. And ultimately, when you've got a league tables, I've always been opposed to league tables, somebody has to be at the bottom. Okay. And that was Bristol.
Okay,
you know what? Many of the kids in Bristol were proud to be at the bottom.
Okay, well, Martin,
because somebody's got to be there.
You've all had your say. And we'll talk now a bit more, I think, about Marvin. I mean, we've got to get his speech, a bit of it anyway, in before 6 o'clock. But before Marvin started speaking on Wednesday, so it was all happening on Wednesday right across the city, at one end, down at Mary Redcliffe and up at the Wills Building, I think it is, at the university at the top of Park Street. Marvin didn't just start speaking. He had, before he started, his own bard, who's this poet, a chap by the name of Miles Chambers, who seems to introduce most of his speeches. In medieval Gaelic and British culture, a bard was a professional storyteller, a verse maker, and a music composer employed by a patron, such as a monarch, to commemorate one or more patron's ancestors and praise the patron's own activities. Well, this is what we seem to have now, almost like a kind of monarchical system with the bard that comes along before the mayor speaks. So let's have a listen to the bard now. That is, at least actually, I'm not going to play the whole of the poem, just the end of the poem. It was a bit difficult because Miles was speaking incredibly quietly, so you could hardly make out what he was saying at some points. But let's listen to the end of his little ditty now, just before Marvin spoke.
I don't want to be the singer, but I want to be the song that weaves into the minds and heart and inspires us and moves things along. I don't want to be the scribe, but I want to be the words on the page, words that motivate and inspire, words that positively enrage. I don't want to be laughter, but I want to be the joy and happiness that resonates with our valleys to tell us, simply be the best. I don't want to be the doctor, but I want to be a part of the cure that gets us to keep asking questions and keep demanding more. This is my story. This is my right. This is my city.
Well, that's the tail end of a little ditty by Miles Chambers there. First of all, you though, Gary, do you think is it good poetry, and does it work as a way to introduce the mayor?
Well, I can only comment that not that long ago, a major news organisation in the city actually spoke to me and said, have you got anybody who can translate Marvin? Because they're fed up with the Mid-Atlantic management gobbledygook and they want plain English.
So is that a yes or no to having the bard appearing before?
I think the bard is irrelevant. I think that we want the person who's supposed to be running the city to speak and communicate in plain English and actually do things.
Jeff?
I think the bard brings a lighter touch to things, and to be honest, I welcome it. I'm not suggesting that Marvin ought to be delivering his speeches in rhyme, and we do need a serious and positive message. I certainly don't always find I'm able to fully understand the point Marvin is making.
And that's very polite. Also, I think it's worth pointing out, it's not rhyme. He's not rhyming. He's just sort of it's that kind of poetry without rhymes. Anyway, Martin, do you think this works? I mean, is it good poetry? Is it a good idea to have a bard introduce you?
Well, I can barely hear what was said. I mean, the question you were saying earlier is it appropriate to have an agenda-setting speech? Because I understand that George Ferguson didn't have a yearly... Did he?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that now part of what goes on? Well, I suppose, do they do this in other cities with mayors? Do they have an agenda-setting speech? Because if they don't, then there is a question mark over it, surely.
Well, it's the State of the Union address, I think. Is it based on?
Well, I know,
idea,
I know, but I mean...
Which is in the US.
I mean, Jeff's in favour of the mayoral system, and Gary and myself aren't. I mean, I'm not really in favour of everything being loaded onto a figurehead
person.
Does
this style work, and does the idea of having the bar beforehand, do you think it
works? Well, if you're going to have that kind of PR approach to things, then you might as well have a bard. But the question is that the right way to do stuff?
It does sound a little bit like, you know, the king, doesn't it? Anyway, let's have a listen to Marvin himself now, where he's speaking about... I think because he's not coming on this programme, he doesn't want to come on the programme, we ought to be having some of these over subsequent weeks. Anyway, he's talking about how the City Council is one of his key tools.
The key tool I have at my disposal is the City Council. But to be effective, I need a council that is of the city in all its diversity. A council that doesn't merely provide services but empowers people and partners. A council that can sometimes stand aside. A council that convenes, listens, asks and enables. Now, our inheritance as an administration has only gradually revealed itself over the year. Alongside government cuts, we faced our own failing financial system, highlighted by the Bundred report, pointing to a tendency to kick difficult decisions down the road. And I asked my Deputy Mayor, Craig Cheney, to lead on finance, place the finance director on the senior leadership team and ask them both to deliver an organisation that is financially disciplined. Balancing the budget remains tough, but we will do it with transparency and our values. And I'm grateful to Craig and the finance director, Denise Murray, for their commitment. And I also want to thank the wider council team for stepping up to the challenge. Now, I've announced our restructure to a streamlined management team that will save the council £750,000 a year. And I'm working with staff to introduce a set of organisational values and a philosophy of work that will take us toward being the development organisation we need to be. Now, nobody's going to vote for us because of it, but one of the most important things we can do is give the city a council that is financially competent. But finance is not our only challenge. The city elects its political leaders, all councillors of all parties. Now, some have fallen into a tired misunderstanding that political leadership means scoring cheap points, tripping up the mayor with tricky questions, or taking debate into the weeds of council processes. But the city elected us to lead, not play placard politics. And again tonight, I say to all parties, we have 3 years before the next election. Step aside from party divides. Come and tell me what you want to achieve. Work with me and the Labour group to get it done. And if results are more important to you than headlines, we will make space for you.
Well, there he's saying, almost saying it directly to you there, Gary. I was thinking maybe that you're one of the people he's saying that have been a bit tricky, asking tricky questions, and that you shouldn't really be doing that.
Well, he seems to find some of the questions rather tricky, and basically we're asking what the people of Bristol want to know. And in terms of providing...
Well, dragging us into the weeds, apparently.
I think you can get it all from the libraries, the approach on that. It was an absolutely lunatic plan put out about how the libraries, two-thirds of them were going to be closed down. Councillors from all parties actually came together, tried to provide a sensible alternative, dismissed out of hand. And there's going to be a couple of minor changes round the edges and a small bone thrown to you, Jeff, for your ward. But, I mean, bluntly, it is absolutely insulting to the thousands of people who responded and all the councillors who tried to provide a better way of doing things. And that just said it all from my point of view.
Well, you know, it's interesting, and I know others might not hold the same view as I do about George Ferguson, but I worked with him in the Cabinet for 3.5 years. And there's an interesting similarity between George and Marvin in this, in that they can't always distinguish between comments that are being made by councillors because they feel something is being done inappropriately, whatever their background, when they feel something isn't being done justly. And that is, I think, very much the issue over the chief executive. There are other things where I think even Gary might admit in the past he has been political in the way he's exploited certain issues. But I think any form of democracy, I would defend the right of people to criticise and challenge, even if I don't agree with those views. And I think it's important that Marvin recognises that people actually care about this city and want to make constructive contributions, but want to raise issues where they feel things are going wrong. And I think there's a danger that people can feel very vulnerable when there are critical comments being made without questioning why they're being made and how justified they are.
It was a bit like George Bush this week, and Obama criticising Trump without actually mentioning his name, Gary. Did you feel a little bit like that? I mean, when I was listening to that, I think, oh, this is aimed at, it must be aimed at the Lib Dems, basically, but without actually mentioning you. And there was a bit of this gobbledygook speak you're in there. Apparently the council is going to become a development organisation. Now, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, we, as I say, a major news organisation in the city asked us for translations of what he's actually saying. People just don't know.
That we're going to lead, listen, ask and enable.
Well, I mean, what a load of baloney that is. They've completely abolished local decision-making by removing the Labour partnerships. Now, they did go through a bad patch under the previous mayor because he sort of made them over-bureaucratic. But the right of local people to have influence on what happens in their area is being removed.
Also, £750,000 is being saved by this reorganisation at the top with the chief executive and the top management.
Well, I can tell you that when the HR committee started asking, can we have the job descriptions to work out whether there's a coherent plan and whether the things are actually going to work, they haven't been worked out yet. So that's some brilliant plan, isn't it? That you're going to completely reorganise the city council, reorganise the management structure. And the original plan actually was devised by the chief executive, who departed halfway through the implementation. And it's designed by also the head of HR, who's on a short-term contract, and we don't know whether she'll be here next week.
Well, it's probably wise for Marvin to get these things done at the early part of his term of office, isn't it? To make sure that if there's any problems, that they're sorted out well before any new election. But anyway, Bristol's Labour Mayor Marvin Rees, you just heard from there. The question is, for me, is can he speak without his VITEC, that's VITEC, auto-cue, / QTV teleprompters? Well, that's what those weird square things, if you saw it on TV or you saw pictures in the Bristol Post, there were kind of two square transparent squares in front of Marvin, and this is £6,000 worth of kit so that you can turn your head from side to side and look like you're speaking from the heart when actually you're just reading someone's script.
I didn't see them.
There's two square transparent things on sticks. At the bottom of that stick is a video screen, so you've got your speech written on the video screen that kind of scrolls up. It's like a TV auto cue, but it's designed for speaking to big audiences. So, certainly Marvin, I'm not. Did you think he wrote his own speech, Gary?
I've no idea.
But he was just reading a script with this weird thing where you turn to one side and then you turn to the other side and you're just reading it off these two scripts.
I think it
sounded like his speech.
Well, you couldn't understand it then.
I said it sounded like his speech.
Anyway, so is Marvin a leader, Gary?
No. I thought we were bad enough with the previous mayor. As I say, it's the system, I think, that's partly to blame. We've gone, you know, through the looking glass now. Some of the stuff that's actually happening is just... he couldn't make it up. It really is absolutely ludicrous. There needs to be a focus on what can be done for the city and making certain that things are done properly and people are actually listened to. As Jeff said, you've got to have challenge. You've got to have councillors being listened to because they represent their communities, and neither George nor Marvin actually has got that concept at all. The people in Hartcliffe elect different people to people in West Beyond Trim, and they want their representatives to be listened to.
Okay, final story, just a general national story, that's in the iNews this week. Half of Britain's adults are potentially vulnerable to financial harm. Research reveals British people on the brink of personal financial crisis as new figures reveal more than 4 million people repeatedly failed to pay their bills in the past 6 months. That's a lot, isn't it? Jeff, this is not looking good, despite all the apparent good figures we keep hearing about more and more people getting jobs from the Prime Minister.
Well, we know that the job story is a really positive one, but we know that a lot of those jobs, people are not earning the rates that they need to be able to afford to live. So actually, you know, and perhaps it does touch on some of the things that Marvin did also talk about, which is the need to remove inequality and to improve the circumstances for those who are most disadvantaged. And actually, that's the only way we're going to get out of this situation, that people find themselves in that situation where they can't pay their bills. We've got a long way to go.
OK, that's time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to our guests, Conservative Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim and Henley, Jeff Gollop, and also Lib Dem leader, Councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. More from Marvin, a bit more.